Welcome to the Healing Trauma and CPTSD Podcast. I'm your host, Monique Coven. I'm a certified trauma recovery coach, and this podcast is all about hope and recovery. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. Today, I'm going to be sitting down with my friend and colleague, Kimberly Weeks. And Kimberly is also a trauma recovery coach, and she specializes in working with both men and women who are recovering from narcissistic abusive relationships with partners. So we're going to be talking all about that in this episode, and I hope that you find this episode informative and helpful. Hi, Kim.
What is happening, Monique Coven? How are you doing? Awesome.
I'm doing good. It's so nice to speak with you again.
Yes, I always love coming in and talking to your listeners. Mm-hmm. You have a really great following. You're doing incredible work supporting survivors of chronic PTSD. So thank you so much for having me back.
Oh, you're welcome. And I don't do it alone. I have people like you, willing to come on and share their expertise. So actually today I'm looking forward to talking about the kind of work you do. You work specifically or predominantly with survivors of narcissistic partner abuse. You yourself are a survivor of being in a relationship with a narcissist. And so I know that you support women, helping them to become more empowered, because after being in a relationship like that, it can be very devastating. So I thought that we could just unpack this whole thing as much as we can in understanding. And I think the best way to start maybe would be, could you give us a definition of what narcissistic abuse or what narcissism is?
Absolutely. And this is a very good conversation to have. There's a lot of people out there in relationships, intimate partner relationships, who are experiencing trauma and wounding and have no language to express or communicate what they're going through. And that makes it very difficult to make decisions with clarity or make just decisions for your best interest. So yeah, let's talk about narcissism and what narcissistic mm-hmm. personality disorder is. From a basic standpoint, narcissistic personality disorder is a type of traumatic behavior and or violation in which a person routinely takes advantage of another human being, and that abuser is on the narcissistic personality disorder spectrum. Now, it's a spectrum because, all of us have a basic level of narcissism, like mm-hmm. self-interest. but there are characteristics that a person can take on that make it toxic, make it damaging to others, and make it something that's actually dangerous for the people they come in contact with. So narcissistic abuse is when a person violates another human being on a consistent basis for the purpose of taking advantage of anything about that other human being for their benefit. And there's some basic characteristics or character traits of a narcissist that I want to make sure that we communicate clearly about. The first is a marked lack of empathy. The person has no ability to empathize or have compassion for other human beings. They can fake that, and they can pretend and mirror empathetic behavior that they see in others, but that's what they're doing. They're actually just acting out empathy. True empathy is when you are willing to be sacrificial of yourself for the benefit of another person. That narcissist does not have the capacity to have empathy for another person. The second thing that narcissists, as part of their character, is a grandiose sense of self-importance. They see themselves as superior. special, and not special like the kindergarten teachers tell you're special, but special meaning that there are things that they are in, you know, able to do because they're so much more important than other people. They have a grandiose sense, an inflated sense of self and self-importance. And that leads into kind of the third characteristic. They have a really high level of entitlement because of that grandiose sense of self. They feel they're entitled to do whatever they want to whomever they want with absolutely no consequence. And everyone is there at their disposal and for their benefit. And it's a very exploitative type of character that narcissists take on. There's some others that are similar: self-centeredness and egotistical or no regard for other people. The person will have a lot of shallow communication that's crafted towards your desires, meaning they're really like studying you mm-hmm. when you communicate. They're casing you, kind of like a robber would case a house, and they are going to mirror back or communicate back everything you say that you want and be that thing for you or that person for you. So in that way, it's shallow because they're not offering anything of in depth from the inside of them. Some people would call them attention harlots or attention whores. They're the people in the room that they're not comfortable with anybody else having attention. They want to be the center of attention wherever they go. And they'll do that with their looks, their money, their materialistic things, education. There's all types of different kinds of narcissists or flavors of narcissists that we could get into. That might be a good second conversation at some point. But they are definitely, you know, out for to be the center of attention. They're also frauds. I call them con artists, imposters. They are a person in public, and then they are a different person in private. They are a completely sham of a person and complete imposters for what they put themselves or present themselves out to be. They're also extremely controlling. They can be very restless, meaning they can't sit still. They can't be still. They're uncomfortable without having a lot of activities in their schedule constantly because that would force them to sit with themselves. So you'll find that narcissists are restless people. Go ahead. You want to say something?
Yeah, I was just thinking. So, I mean, we're hearing you're describing all of these traits, and you know, I'm thinking in my mind, well, nobody would want to be with someone like that. So naturally, as you were describing, they're studying you. They're figuring out kind of like, what do you want to hear? So, what is it like, you know, when a person first meets, let's say, the narcissist and is potentially, you know, going to get into some sort of a romantic type of relationship? How are they in the relationship? Like, why do people fall for is what I'm trying to say.
I love this question because as I'm describing these characteristics, as I'm saying, this person is totally irresponsible. They're totally about their image. They ghost you. They're impulsive. They can be dangerous. They're rageful. They want all this center of attention. It doesn't sound like a very attractive package, does it?
No, sounds like you're going to run the other way.
And that is why, in many instances, what character traits I'm describing to you are not character traits that you are going to see in a person when they first meet you. When they first meet you, they are going to present you with a ideal, almost Prince Charming-like or charismatic, you know, personality. They're going to be the life of the party. They're going to be the person that's so kind and, you know, is altruistic and helpful and, you know, all of those things. And if you're in an intimate partner relationship, you're talking about the perfect date, the perfect, I mean, perfect gentleman or perfect, you know, gentlewoman presented to you. I mean, they literally are doing, they're checking every box as it relates to appropriate, kind, generous, loving behavior when you interact with them. And they want to present an image to you. I've heard it said the person is a master of managing people's perceptions. They present an image to you that is just so over the top incredible that it's it's almost a sweep you off your feet type of environment. And that's why it's disarming, because all of those character traits are only things that a person will be able to see, as I described at first, low empathy, grandiose, entitled, self-centered. You're not going to see that side of the narcissist if you are not in a very close relationship with them. And when that could be the partner, that could be their children. Okay. That could be somebody in their family system. You have to see that person over a long period of time in order to see those character traits reveal themselves. They call it the mask slipping. Okay. You would have to be around them for a long time to see their mask slip, their image slip in front of you. For the untrained person or the person who has had no experience with them, it can be almost, you know, impossible to believe that the person isn't the ideal person that they're presenting to you. They're very, very good at acting this out.
I'm just thinking that, you know, we see in movies, the way that, you know, Prince Charming sweeps someone off their feet. And it's like, of course, you know, the woman or the man who's going to meet this person, they're going to think, oh, my goodness, like I have found the man or woman of my dreams.
Exactly.
Just like in the movies.
Exactly. I call it the Disneyfication of society. We've created this ideal image. I actually had when I was, you know, on a date, the person tell me who their dream girl was. And that there are people that have built up in their minds this ultra superhuman fantasy of a person. And that is what the narcissist will present to whomever they're trying to attach to for the purpose of exploiting them. It's quite fascinating, to be honest with you. And that's what makes it so, I guess the right word is diabolical. Because these character traits that you can only see if you're close to the person, that you can only see if you're in the family system with the person, is what they show to people in their private life. It isn't the person they present in public or at their job or in environments where they're trying to impress other people. It is a completely opposite personality that they present. So it's almost like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Yeah. Yeah. And I can just imagine, you know, let's say this is going on behind closed doors and you want to tell people or tell your community, but they might have difficulty believing that because they're only seeing this wonderful, kind, giving human being.
Right.
And you're describing someone they haven't seen.
You're describing a person that sounds like, you know, sociopathic or psychopathic, or the calculated level, the level of disorder that you're dealing with a person with narcissistic personality disorder, you're describing a danger to society. And it's an interesting point because there's some different components, or I guess different parts of the narcissistic abuse cycle that I think are important for your listeners to hear about, because without the understanding of that cycle, it is very easy to be entrapped in it and a lot worse or more difficult to get out of. So your question, you know, begs the question to me, okay, so how in the world do these people see this person as such an incredible person? And yet the other parts of the person are, you know, withheld for privacy of, you know, their intimate partners or their families. So the first part of the abuse cycle for narcissistic abuse survivors is the idealized phase. This is where everybody in public is. They're in the ideal person is being presented to them. And in kind, the person who is, you know, being cased or, you know, trying to be attracted by the narcissist will be idolized as well. They will be given lots of time, attention, interest. This is like, again, Prince Charming, gifts, all kinds of expressions of love. We call it love bombing. I mean, just this over the top, you know, presenting of the perfect person to you. And that's what they do in public to people who they come into contact with at work, you know, who they see once a year at Christmas or Thanksgiving. They present that ideal person, and they also pour that idealization onto the person they're trying to be in a relationship with. That's the first phase of the abuse cycle. And what happens in that part is it will bond the abuser or the narcissist to their victim, because it comes along with not just these love expressions materialistically and time and attention, but often it's a very fast-paced, fast-moving part of the relationship that includes, you know, sex and excitement and trips and all the rest of this stuff, and you're completely swept off your feet. We know just from being trauma recovery coaches that, you know, anytime you have sex with somebody and you're releasing oxytocin, that's called the love hormone, it actually causes a very deep bond with the person if you have it on a repeated basis. So this person becomes in like a total Casanova to create that cocktail in your body and bond you quickly to them as a person. That's the first phase, idolizing them, the idolized phase. The next phase of narcissistic abuse is the devaluation phase. That sense of the relationship, they start eroding and tearing it down in the devaluation stage. And so there, that's the second part of the abuse cycle. They start with idolizing you, and then they tear down the idol that they've made you in their minds, and they start to devalue and tear you down. And then it moves into the third phase of the abuse cycle, which is the discard phase of the abuse cycle. And they will literally abandon the whole life that they have built with you, they've created with you. And it is a very devastating part of the abuse cycle. It truly is. And most clients will come to me in the discard phase of the abuse cycle because their whole minds are just completely turned around, and they have no idea what's going on and are looking for answers. They're looking for help.
I mean, this is just so... I mean, I've worked with some women myself who have been in relationships with partners who have narcissistic tendencies to different degrees, some really, really bad. And I hear everything that you're saying about the devaluing when, you know, at one point they were Prince Charming, the crazy making and questioning. And so, you know, what we want to talk about here, and always what I hope to do is offer hope, because, you know, when we hear things like this, you just get a sense of like dread, like, oh my goodness. So you work with women like this. What can you speak to us about healing and hope and recovery and empowerment? And how does someone start to move away from this type of relationship?
I love that question. I do. And I think that that's one of the beautiful parts of being able to take experiences that you've had and support other survivors. That's one of the reasons why I think it's important. Even listening to the content that we've, you know, discussed today, a part of you moving away or beginning to move away is understanding what you're dealing with. Most survivors of narcissistic abuse come for answers. They start reading books and blogs and podcasts and, you know, all of those types of things, and going to counselors, because they have no understanding of what happened between that love bombing phase and being discarded like a piece of trash or abandoned completely. A lot of these people have had children. They've been in relationships 10, 20, some people 30 years. They've built a life and put their trust in that person. And it's like the rug has been pulled from underneath them. So the first step in, you know, restoring hope for your life is understanding what you're dealing with, not just with the narcissist, but the impact that it's had on you, and being able to have a place to have a supportive environment to be validated, to be heard, to be believed. And I'm going to say that because a lot of abuse survivors, domestic violence survivors, try to tell people what they're dealing with at home and what has happened to them, and often are blamed or victimized or re-traumatized further by someone saying, or, you know, something that is inconsistent with support for that person. So a lot of what survivors need is just to be heard and to be believed. This is, you know, as I've described it today, it's almost like a movie. It's almost like a Law and Order SVU type of situation. It's almost unbelievable. Mm-hmm. So for an abuse victim to come to a person and, you know, a family member, a loved person, a friend, or someone close to them and say, here's what's happening to me, and have their story or account called into question or minimized, mm-hmm. or not believed or turned around to make it their fault is devastating. So a lot of what I do with my clients is I sit and hold the space with their experience. I have already walked through it myself. Mm-hmm. So I'm able to impart them with understanding.
Well, I think it's you're giving them understanding, and you're giving them words that, you know, those experiences can be so overwhelming. And, you know, I'm thinking frontal cortex offline, and just like not being able to really figure out what the heck is happening, you know?
Yeah. There's something about language that makes the person who has been a victim feel like they're not going crazy. Like this is a real thing. And there's other people who have experienced this. And yes, they have the same experience that I had. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there might be some different details, but from a basic standpoint, like it opens that person's mind up to all the devaluation, all of the gaslighting, all of the calling their, you know, reality into question in walking through the recovery process with survivors. All of a sudden, everything makes sense. Mm-hmm. And it has names. And it's a real thing. And there's something that happens. I can see the shift that happens in survivors when they start to realize that they were not crazy this whole time. And what was happening to them was truly a violation. And so you go through the stages of grief. They go through all of the different expressions of, you know, sadness and depression and, you know, feeling some kind of, you know, guilt and shame. And I mean, just all of those different things, you know, they go through all of those things. And to have someone holding their hand while they go through it that says, I know, I've been there, I get it. I understand and can give them some guidance and direction and some support tools and resources is so helpful. Mm-hmm. It really is. Mm-hmm. Because here's what can happen. You know, you have that abuse cycle and they've been idealized and devalued and they've been discarded. What can happen without that support after they've been discarded is the last part of the abuse cycle, which is where a narcissist will actually keep what I call a narcissistic harem of ex-lovers or ex-victims, that when they get bored with the person they're with now, the new supply of attention and adoration, they will actually, what's called hoover back exes so that they can continue to have, you know, the supply that they need for the process that they're in the abuse cycle. It's just like the Hoover vacuum. They will suck you back into that same cycle of idealized, devalue, and discard. And so obviously that's re-traumatizing. Obviously that causes more damage. Mm-hmm. And if a person doesn't have language for the experience, they don't get that they were never cared about truly by that person, that they're actually in some kind of a mind control game playing situation, when the person comes back love bombing and saying they're so sorry and they miss them. And what about the good times when they come back with all that? It's going to activate that the bond that they originally had with the person. And they're going to think, maybe, you know, we can give this another shot. And that hoovering process is, again, textbook for the narcissistic abuse cycle. So having a support person and communities of people who've had the same experience so that you do not be, you know, you don't get entrapped and duped again into getting back into that cycle with the narcissist is so vitally important. I can't tell you how many times I've had clients say, well, I have been with different men or different women, but they've all treated me the same way. So they have re-entered the abuse cycle with a different face and a different name. Hmm. So not so healing and doing the personal inner work to determine where this, you know, pattern was demonstrated to you in your childhood or in your life as a young adult. And, you know, what that taught you about who you are, what that taught you about, you know, what love and what, you know, a healthy relationship looks like, or a relationship looks like, and, you know, what is appropriate in terms of setting boundaries for other people. If you don't have that framework and support system, you can easily find yourself going through the narcissistic abuse cycle with multiple people across a lifetime.
Yeah.
Which is obviously something that no one wants to do and no one willingly does, kind of like what you said at the beginning. No one willingly wants to go back into that situation. But if you don't mm-hmm. understand what you're dealing with, and I think, you know, I want to drop this truth bomb because I think it's an important point to make for people who have experienced this type of abuse or violation. And it's a hard truth, so brace yourself. but there has to become a point when a person accepts that the narcissist never loved them, never cared about them. And there has to come a point where that person accepts that the person they fell in love with is actually not a real person. They fell in love with the character, that the role that that person was playing, the false self that was presented to them. And I'm telling you, that as long as a person continues to believe that, you know, there's goodness, and I'm not saying that, I'm not mm-hmm. going to make a black and white statement here, but that the person was, you know, in a genuine relationship with them, as long as there's a hope of that, there is an easy, they become easy prey for that particular narcissist and other narcissists as well. Mm-hmm. We have to come into the reality of an acceptance that the person we thought we were, you know, in a relationship with is not a real person. And that is a hard truth to accept, mm-hmm. but it is a truth that'll set a person free, truly, because it will make it very clear that all of the desires that we have for relationship, we can now take all of that energy and start pouring it into ourselves as we heal from the, you know, from the abuse. And, you know, start discovering what we really want in relationships, what we really need, and start going out to, you know, look for and you know, have a desire for healthier relationship dynamics moving forward. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty interesting.
And also maybe some, I don't know, I'm going to say bigger antennas. That yeah. kind of maybe you'll know what to look for. Or...
Absolutely. It's called wisdom and discernment. And what will happen through this experience, one of the gifts of narcissistic abuse, and I will say that, one of the gifts of narcissistic abuse is it will train you to understand how to look for authenticity in other people. It will train you to look for red flags. It will train you to understand when you are being moved at a very fast pace in a relationship mm-hmm. and you don't have time to really get to know or see that person over a long, you know, a period of time to see if their character is for real. It is actually a gift Because it will teach you how valuable what's on the inside of you is, how valuable the treasure your heart is, and it will cause you to guard it with a lot more diligence. That's the truth. That is absolutely, it'll put your antennas up. And you, and the point of doing the work and the recovery work and the healing work is so that you don't, you know, wall yourself up so strongly that you don't, you know, have the courage again to step into getting into an intimate partner relationship again. Yes, it takes time to heal. Yes, you need to spend some time with yourself to rediscover who you are. But not everybody out there behaves this way. And I think that it's an important thing to note that if you do the personal work, then you'll know what you need and what you want out of relationship dynamics, right, so that you can identify that in other people. Yeah.
Yeah. That's good.
Yeah, that's really good.
Well, so tell us, Kim, if people want to find out more about your work or get in touch with you, how can they find you?
If they want to find out more about, you know, anything that has to do with narcissistic abuse recovery, they can look me up on my website at thenarcissisticabusecoach.com. I am also on that same handle at Facebook and Instagram. And I'm actually in the process right now of building out a new recovery community, an academy for relational abuse survivors. I can't wait to launch it. It's going to be the Kimberly Weeks Freedom Academy, and should be launching shortly, but it'll be a place for survivors to have a support group, as well as trauma-informed coaching and teaching and training, and the ability to get resources and tools to help them in their recovery process. So I can't wait to launch it, and I'm looking forward to, you know, other survivors having a community and a tribe of people who understand it and get it, so that they don't feel alone as they're going through this recovery process.
Oh, that's awesome, Kim. So thanks again for being with us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Monique. Have a great one.
Trauma healing and recovery starts to happen in the context of a safe, attuned, and empathetic relationship. To find out more about my trauma recovery coaching options, you could reach me on my website at www.cptsdcoach.com. You can also visit me on Instagram and Facebook at cptsdcoach.com.